that might help narrow down a suspect. What would he tell reporters when they asked the inevitable question, did police think the rapist would strike again? DiGiossio listened as officers shared whatever evidence they had. She wasn't sure she wanted to chime in with her own discovery. After all, it was just a report of a white truck parked near Lily's house. She hadn't even bothered to tell Hassel about it as they drove to the meeting. She didn't want to look foolish. Maybe the investigators would dismiss her because she was a crime analyst, not a street cop. Some might look down on her because she was a woman. Law enforcement was a man's world. And even though Hendershot and Galbraith were there, the room was mostly tall white guys with short haircuts. You have to be a different kind of female to be able to hold your own in this profession, she says. You have to be strong enough to hold your own, but not so strong that people call you a bitch. You have to find your place. You still have to be you. Before the meeting, DiGiossio hadn't realized how brutal the rapist was, nor how many women he had attacked. It was news to me. Now the meeting was starting to break up. Some of the cops stood talking in small groups. Others were leaving the room. DiGiossio decided to speak up. I looked at suspicious vehicles and suspicious calls, she told the cops at the long table. I don't know if this is a big deal or not. I found this one call. It was a person in a white truck. Galbraith was talking with another police officer. She stopped mid-sentence. What had DiGiossio said? White truck. Galbraith flashed to the white truck from the videotape, circling Amber's apartment complex on the night of the rape. Do you have any details? Galbraith said, getting to her feet. DiGiossio brought her laptop over to Galbraith. The license plate traced back to a 1993 white Mazda pickup truck. The truck on the videotape was a Mazda. Who's the registered owner? Galbraith asked, her eyes racing across the screen, seeking an answer. DiGiossio had researched that too. She brought up another file. It was an image of the driver's license of the man who owned the white truck. At the top was a name. Chapter 11. A Gross Misdemeanor. The last week of August, 2008. Linwood, Washington. It looked like a traffic ticket. It was even on the same form used for traffic offenses, a one-page, fill-in-the-blank citation, with one box at the top labeled traffic, another labeled non-traffic. On the page Marie held in her hand, the non-traffic box was marked with an X. The envelope came in the mail in late August, less than 3 weeks after she had reported being raped. When she opened it, she discovered she was being charged with a crime. False reporting, the citation said, the two words written by hand in all capital letters. The form didn't say what kind of charge this was, a misdemeanor, a felony, nor what the penalty might be. But the citation listed the state statute she stood accused of violating, RCW 9A84040. With that and Google, she could answer her questions. False reporting was a gross misdemeanor, the most serious charge short of a felony. A conviction could land her in jail for up to a year. The text of the statute reads, a person is guilty of false reporting if, with knowledge that the information reported, conveyed, or circulated is false, he or she initiates or circulates a false report or warning of an alleged occurrence or impending occurrence of a fire, explosion, crime, catastrophe, or emergency, knowing that such false report is likely to cause evacuation of a building, place of assembly, or transportation facility, or to cause public inconvenience or alarm. Boiled down, Marie stood accused of creating a false scare, claiming she was raped when she knew she wasn't. The news devastated Marie. She had given the police what they wanted, given them a written statement, given up her demand for a polygraph. And now this. Now, any hope of moving on, of getting past it, was gone. She didn't know the court system. She had no idea how long this prosecution would take or how it would turn out. But she knew she'd probably find out alone. Her friends were now few. They wouldn't be lining up to accompany her to the courthouse. Marie needed to appear in Linwood Municipal Court to enter a plea. If she failed to show for her arraignment, she could be arrested. A fill-in-the-blank form dropped in the mail seems a casual way to alert someone to the threat of a year in jail. But the means of notifying Marie was in keeping with how the decision had been reached. There had been nothing complicated about the charging process. No mandatory review within the police department. No sign-off by a prosecuting attorney. Sergeant Mason filled in the citation and signed at the bottom. It was his decision alone to charge Marie. And for Mason, the decision had been easy. Mason had no doubt Marie had lied. The law said her lie was a crime. Where there is a crime and a culprit, there follows a charge. It was that straightforward, Mason says. Penalties for false reporting can be severe. Research by Lisa Avalos, a University of Arkansas law professor, shows that while 42 states, including Washington, treat false reporting as a misdemeanor, 8 make it a felony. In Illinois and Wyoming, it carries a sentence of up to 5 years in prison. It's 6 years in Arkansas. False reporting is also a felony on the federal level, where it can lead to a 5-year sentence and a maximum fine of $250,000. And the United States seems downright lenient compared to the United Kingdom. There, the crime, called perverting the course of justice, carries a maximum sentence of life in prison. For the police, it stands to reason that the punishment could be stiff. A false report wastes resources. In Marie's case, patrol officers, crime scene technicians, detectives, a police commander, and an ambulance crew scrambled to the apartment complex, diverting them from other duties or calls. Later, at the hospital, a doctor and a specially trained nurse conducted a lengthy examination of Marie, which kept them from other patients. Mason and his colleagues had devoted more time to the case in the days that followed. And then there was the effect the case had on the public at large. Marie's story of rape had been broadcast widely in the Seattle metropolitan area. A stranger had broken into a home and attacked a woman at knife point. That no doubt caused alarm, and the people who shared her apartment building and housing program would have been particularly rattled. In Marie's case, the police had no suspect. But if they had, an innocent person could have been put through the crucible of being questioned by police. The suspect's family might have been questioned, maybe co-workers, maybe neighbors. Worse, an innocent person could have been charged, even convicted. False accusations can produce waves of publicity, imperiling reputations. In 2006, 3 Duke lacrosse players were accused of raping an exotic dancer. They weren't cleared until the following year. The case's prosecutor, found to have withheld exculpatory DNA evidence, wound up being disbarred and jailed for a day. In 2014, Rolling Stone would publish an explosive story in which a student described being gang raped by members of a fraternity at the University of Virginia. The student's account was soon discredited by other media and the police, and the following year, the magazine retracted the story in its entirety. One journalism institute named the story Error of the Year. Rolling Stone wound up settling defamation lawsuits filed by both the fraternity and a university administrator who alleged that the story wrongly turned her into the face of institutional indifference. Marie's case in Linwood had a recent parallel just a few miles south. In March of 2008, 5 months before Marie reported being raped, a woman in King County, Washington, had pleaded guilty to false reporting and been sentenced to 8 days in jail. But her story had done more harm than Marie's. She had accused a specific person, a college professor, of rape, and had gone so far as to alter email messages from him, making it appear he had professed romantic interest and promised a higher grade if she met a few conditions. The professor had been arrested and spent 9 days in jail before being cleared. For the Linwood police, the formal determination that Marie had made a false report meant the rape investigation was over. There was nothing to investigate. No more evidence would be gathered. The neighborhood canvass would go unfinished. At the apartments where no one had answered, 6 in Marie's old building, 7 in the building nearby, no officer would go back and try again. The evidence that had already been collected would now be disposed of according to department protocol. Once enough time passed, Marie's bedding would be destroyed. So would the hairs and fibers from her bed and the DNA swabs from the sliding glass door. So too would the rape kit. Even Marie's account, the very story itself, would disappear from the official record. Every year, the FBI collects crime data from police departments around the country. Law enforcement uses the data to plan budgets, researchers to study trends, legislators to draft crime bills. In its annual filing sent to the FBI, Linwood designated Marie's rape claim as unfounded. The catch-all tag for any reported crime deemed baseless or false. In all, 10 rapes were reported to the Linwood police in 2008. The police labeled 4 as unfounded. On September 11th, the day of her arraignment, Marie didn't show up in court. Failure to appear is a crime, so the prosecutor asked the judge to issue a warrant for Marie's arrest. The judge agreed. Now, Marie was looking at 2 potential charges, and the possibility of being arrested, handcuffed, and booked into jail the next time she came across a police officer. Linwood Municipal Court can be a confusing place. It's busy, for one thing. In 2008, Marie's was one of 4,859 misdemeanor cases. The court also handled 13,450 infractions, mostly traffic-related. For those charged or ticketed, the court can be a vertiginous hive, a swarm of suits coming and going. Key functions get farmed out. A private law office, Zacher and Thomas, prosecutes the cases. Another contractor, N-Court, handles payments made online or over the phone, charging extra for the convenience. As a case moves forward, fines, fees, and other legal obligations can multiply. Defendants like Marie are usually required to attend each hearing, even if that hearing proves to consist entirely of entering a postponement and scheduling the next hearing, at which the defendant might show up to learn that the matter is being postponed yet again. In a message posted online, the court's judge, Stephen E. Moore, says the court's goal is to correct behavior, to make Linwood a better, safer, healthier place to live, work, shop, and visit. The court's overriding value is customer service. It is sometimes difficult for people who've been issued a traffic ticket or charged with a crime to think of themselves as customers, but they are. Everyone, victim, witness, juror, or defendant may expect to be treated with professionalism and respect, the judge writes. On September 12th, Marie showed up at the counter at Linwood Municipal Court to ask about her case. She knew nothing of the hearing scheduled the day before. She had no idea there was a warrant out for her arrest. A clerk rooted through the paperwork and discovered that the hearing notice had, for some reason, been sent to an address in Seattle, not to Marie's home in Linwood. So the court rescheduled the arraignment and canceled the arrest warrant. But if not for Marie's diligence, checking in to see what was up, she could have been hauled in and spent the night in jail. When the arraignment was held on September 25th, Marie was represented by a public defender, James Feldman. Like the prosecutor, Feldman worked in Linwood's court part-time under a contract. He managed a small private firm that did criminal and civil cases, fielding everything from domestic violence and DUIs to dog bites and slip and falls. When he reviewed Marie's case, Feldman, who had 34 years of experience, was surprised she had been charged. Her story hadn't hurt anyone. No suspect had been arrested or even questioned. His guess was that the police felt used. They don't appreciate having their time wasted. At the hearing, Marie pleaded not guilty. Her next court date was set for 6 weeks later, on November 10th. On October 6th, 2008, a 63-year-old woman in Kirkland, Washington, reported being sexually assaulted. Kirkland is just east of Seattle. Abutting Lake Washington, the suburb is dotted with art galleries, bronze sculptures, and marinas. The woman, a grandmother, lived alone in a ground-floor condominium in a two-story building. Her complex was a sun-dappled, forested enclave with towering trees, splashes of pink and purple rhododendrons, and trails covered with leaves, bark, and small pine cones. She told police she awoke at about 4 a.m. to find a man, his face covered by black mesh, holding a gloved hand over her mouth. His other hand held a knife to her throat. "Don't scream," he told her. He tied her hands, using the laces from one of her pink tennis shoes. He groped her. He took photographs. He placed the knife's tip under one of her eyes and said he could cut it out. When she struggled, the knife sliced the web of her hand between thumb and index finger. When she asked him why he was doing this, he laughed. He told her not to call the police. He said he would know if she did. The woman said the man had white, white skin, sloping shoulders, smooth hands, and bad breath. As for age, she couldn't say. He might have been 40. He could have been 15. "I don't know," she told police. Nor could she distinguish his size. "His build was pretty average," she said. "He wasn't big. He wasn't muscular. He wasn't tiny. He wasn't skinny." The Kirkland Police Department assigned two detectives to the case, Corporal Jack Kazee and Audra Weber. The crime struck both as unusual, beginning with its level of cruelty and calculation. "You know, it's Kirkland. You don't expect those kinds of things to happen," Kazee says. "We often refer to ourselves as Beverly Hills North." For Weber, the case had elements of a locked room mystery, the kind written by Edgar Allan Poe or Ellery Queen. The grandmother had taken pains to safeguard her home. A metal bar secured her front door. She placed rods in the tracks of her rear sliding glass door and bedroom window. How did the attacker get in? Weber wondered. The grandmother offered one possibility. She had been tired the night before and had fallen asleep with the TV on. Maybe when she woke up and turned off the TV, she'd gone to bed without remembering to lock the sliding door. For 2 to 3 months before the attack, the grandmother told police, she'd felt as if someone had been following her. Afterward, she had called 911, only to startle at the dispatcher's voice. The voice seemed to be her attacker's. He must have intercepted her call to police, she thought. He must have been telling the truth when he said he would know. She was so convinced of this that she refused to answer any of the dispatcher's questions. Kazee conducted a long interview with the grandmother. At times, her answers went in unexpected directions. "Do you ever get a weird feeling about anybody?" Kazee asked. "Yeah." "And share that with me?"
There are raccoons."
"Uh-huh."
"There are people that let their dogs out. They go back and forth."
"Uh-huh."
"You know, there are small animals and chipmunks. A couple times, I've felt just creepy." At the police station, Kazee heard skepticism from some of his fellow officers. They couldn't believe this crime, so malevolent and serpentine as to be a candidate for one of those A&E crime shows, could have been committed in their placid suburb. "I had several people coming by my desk saying, 'Ah, come on, this didn't happen.' And my response was, 'I don't know that it didn't happen. It's human nature, I guess. Or maybe that's just what happens in the cop world. Everybody lies. Everybody lies to cops.'" But at no time did anyone tell him to stop pursuing the case. It was just office talk that you get from time to time. The detectives on the case wrestled with some doubts of their own. But ultimately, the grandmother's idiosyncrasies didn't throw Kazee, who had ample experience with trauma as a domestic violence detective and as a hostage negotiator. "Nobody acts the same," he says. "I've done a countless number of death notifications. I've seen every possible reaction that you can imagine. The same goes with rape victims, sexual assault victims." Nor was he thrown by any inconsistencies in her description of what happened. "Most victims will, the core issue, they're firm on. It's the stuff that happens around that they'll deviate from, and that's not unusual. Until I found some reason not to believe her, I believed her," Kazee says. Shannon, sitting at home with her husband, learned about the Kirkland attack while watching the television news. "Oh my God," she thought. "I was wrong. The police were wrong. Marie must have really been raped." The Kirkland attack took place 2 months after and 13 miles away from the one Marie had reported in Linwood. Shannon seized on the parallels, the breaking in, the binding of hands, the taking of photographs. She wasted no time. Shannon's father had been the chief of police in Kent, south of Seattle. She grew up with police, trusted police, knew how the police worked. She went to her computer, looked up the telephone number, and called, immediately, to alert the Kirkland police to Marie's story and all the similarities. The detectives she reached said Kirkland would check into it. After that, Shannon called Marie. She told Marie about the newscast and urged her to call the Kirkland police herself, to share what she had reported in Linwood, to make sure that any possible connection would be investigated. Marie refused. She'd been through enough already, and, with the pending criminal charge, was facing more ahead. She couldn't bring herself to reach out to the police, any police, to say anything more. But she did go online and look up what had happened to the grandmother in Kirkland. And when she read the story, she cried. For a detective, tying one unsolved crime to another can revive an investigation. Evidence multiplies, patterns emerge. Detective Weber called the Linwood police not once, but twice, to see if there might be a link. Both times Linwood told her, "We have no crime to connect. Our victim was no victim." She admitted to making her story up. So Weber let it go. I just kind of trusted their judgment in terms of it's their case. They know the details, and I don't. Still, she was kind of shocked to learn they had charged Marie. She hung up the phone and thought, "Okay, I hope that works out for you guys." "That's so extreme to do that," Weber says. She figured there must be some backstory. Perhaps the woman in Linwood had a history of lying and wasting the police's time. Kazee, Weber's partner on the Kirkland case, also called the Linwood police and was told the same thing. He had the same reaction as Weber. "Oh, that's not good," he thought, upon hearing of the false reporting charge. "Just because it's on the books doesn't mean you have to charge somebody with it," he says. One of the Kirkland detectives got back to Shannon to share what their department had learned. Linwood's case was closed, so Kirkland was dropping Shannon's lead. Shannon suggested the Kirkland police go talk to Marie for themselves, but the detectives never did. "That was the end," Shannon says. Shannon was now more confused than ever. The way she had latched onto the Kirkland story made her realize maybe she hadn't been so sure after all that Marie was a liar. "I did want to believe her," Shannon says. "I loved her." But Marie's reluctance to follow up and reassert her innocence brought all the doubts back. The Kirkland case had given Marie a second chance to talk to police, different police, not the detectives in Linwood, and to insist she had been raped, to insist her case be reopened and connected to Kirkland's. That Marie wouldn't do it convinced Shannon anew. Marie had lied. She hadn't been raped. Shannon was left to wonder, once again, what really happened inside Marie's apartment. In November, Marie went back to court. Sitting there, waiting her turn, she had no idea what the people next to her had been accused of. It could have been speeding or shoplifting. It could have been a hit and run or domestic violence. When Marie's case was called, Feldman, her public defender, told the judge that the defense had no pretrial motions to offer. And that was pretty much it for the day. Marie was told to come back next month. When she returned in December, her case was pushed back to January. She returned in January to learn her case was being postponed until February. In February, the case was continued until March. Finally, the prosecution made Marie an offer. Called a pretrial diversion agreement, the deal amounted to this. If Marie met certain conditions for the next year, the false reporting charge would be dropped. She would need to get mental health counseling for her lying. She would need to go on supervised probation. She would need to keep straight, breaking no more laws. And she would have to pay $500 to cover the court's costs. To Feldman, this was a good offer. If Marie met the terms of the agreement, she could walk away without a record. Marie wanted this behind her. So in March, she went to court, accompanied only by her lawyer for what was her sixth appearance, and took the deal. In Kirkland, Corporal Kazee worked the case. He went from condo to condo in the victim's complex and in another complex nearby, asking if anyone saw or heard anything. He sought out maintenance workers and questioned them. He interviewed one neighbor who had been inside the grandmother's home, helping her hook up a television 2 or 3 months before the attack. He interviewed another who reported that someone had tried breaking into her own home. He went to nearby businesses, a grocery store, a gas station, a drugstore, to track down surveillance video from the morning of the assault. He rounded up information on other attacks in Seattle, in the nearby towns of Shoreline, Kenmore, and SeaTac, to see if there might be any connection. But after 2 months, with all those leads exhausted, Kazee had to give up the case. He was being rotated back to patrol. Any follow-up would be Weber's to handle. Between Christmas and New Year's, the two detectives reviewed the investigation while going over the handoff. They concluded there was one last hope, DNA. The investigation had produced a decent suspect. On the morning the grandmother had reported being attacked, a Kirkland officer, responding to the call, had pulled into the condominium complex at about 5:30. In the parking lot, he spotted a man in the passenger seat of a Toyota, its engine running. When the officer walked up and tapped the window, the man gave his name, along with his date of birth. The officer called the information into dispatch to run a computer check. The man told the officer he lived in one of the units with a friend. He worked as a machinist. His roommate worked at the same shop. This morning, he was grabbing a cigarette while waiting for his roommate to come out and drive them to work. The officer thanked the machinist for his time and began walking away. Then he heard back from dispatch. The machinist had a warrant out for his arrest. The warrant had been issued in June for indecent exposure. So the machinist was in the area and had a criminal sheet with a sex offense. He also wore a sweatshirt that fit what the police were looking for. But the machinist said it wasn't him. He said he had been in his condo since 2 o'clock the afternoon before. And when the police drove the grandmother by to eyeball him, she said she didn't think he was the attacker, although she couldn't be sure. Plus, he was 6'4", 240 pounds, hardly an average build. Nonetheless, he remained a suspect, unless and until he could be excluded. At the Washington State Patrol Crime Lab, an analyst swabbed the shoelace that had been used to tie up the grandmother and had detected male DNA. The sample wasn't sufficient to develop a full genetic profile, but it would allow for YSTR analysis, the testing that can narrow in on a paternal family line. The state didn't do that kind of analysis, but some private labs did. Weber asked the machinist if he would provide a DNA sample for comparison purposes. He agreed, allowing the detective to swab the inside of his cheek. In July 2009, Weber sent those cheek swabs and the shoelaces to a private lab. Then she waited. Given its limitations, the analysis would not be able to determine, for sure, that the machinist was a match. But it could say for sure if he wasn't. 6 weeks later, on the last day of August, Weber heard back. The machinist was ruled out. The DNA belonged to someone else. For Weber, that was it. There was nothing else to do. On September 2nd, she designated the case as inactive and moved on. Marie's plea deal removed the threat of jail, but her sense of loss lingered. The months and years following that morning in Linwood hollowed her out. She stopped going to church. "I was mad at God," she says. With her withdrawal from church, her relationship with Jordan withered. "We stayed friends, but we didn't talk like we used to." She lost interest in photography. She stayed in her apartment and watched a lot of television. She shelved thoughts of college. She took jobs that made few demands. "I hurt so bad. This deep, dark hole I was in. It was hard for me to do much." She worked at a clothing store, handling the cash register, tagging, stocking. She worked at a collection agency, taking messages, doing data entry. She did sales at a store that sold discount items for parties. The learner's permit that the police had found in her apartment was supposed to be temporary, a step along her path to independence. But she never took the next step, never got her license. She took the bus to work. Self-esteem gave way to self-loathing. She started smoking, drinking, gaining weight. She made bad choices, taking up with troubled people who stole her money. She felt like everyone shunned her, and she wasn't alone in sensing this. Shannon saw it too. All the people in her circle of friends and support people just didn't want to have anything to do with her, Shannon says. Marie suffered from depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. That was the diagnosis she received from a specialist she consulted as part of her plea deal. Some days she'd declare herself happy as could be. Other days she was tired, dead to the world, unable to shake the thought that she had given up everything, that the normalcy she craved would never be hers. As ordered by the court, Marie saw a counselor for a year. She dreaded it at first, then she settled in. In counseling, you're not judged. It felt nice to tell my story when I'm not shut down. The two were supposed to work through Marie's life, building up to the lie she had told. But a year was not long enough, Marie says. Once she had covered everything else, Marie had time to talk just once about what happened that summer morning in Linwood. I gave her the whole story, Marie says. She couldn't tell if the counselor believed her or not. Chapter 12. Marks. February 11th, 2011. Lakewood, Colorado. Mark Patrick O'Leary. That was the name on the driver's license displayed on the laptop screen in front of Galbraith. O'Leary was just over 6 feet tall. He weighed 220 pounds. His hair was blonde. His eyes were hazel. His face seemed square, heavy, like a clay doll. His lips were thick, his hair short. He had a prominent brow. He lived at 65 Harlan Street in Lakewood. His birth date, June 22, 1978. Galbraith did the math. He was 32 years old. It's him, she thought. Galbraith felt a pang of regret. She hadn't told her fellow investigators about the white truck because she didn't consider it a strong lead. It was luck, just pure luck, that DiGiosio had found it. But sometimes that's what it took. Galbraith quickly explained the connection to the other cops around the table in the Westminster conference room. A white Mazda in the vicinity of two of the victims. The victim's description of the attacker matched O'Leary's driver's license. The cops in the room, Hendershot, Galbraith, Burgess, and Hassel, had lived blurred days in the month since Amber's rape. They had dug in dumpsters and ditches, questioned college kids and cable guys, created a task force on the fly, and collaborated with each other's crime scene investigators and crime analysts. They had exhausted themselves, certain that a serial rapist was loose. Now, with a suspect finally identified, they would work even harder. The conference room in the Westminster Police Department cleared out. The cops raced back to their offices to dig into one question. Who was this guy? Galbraith checked the National Crime Information Center, which showed no criminal record, not even a traffic ticket. She enlisted her husband, David, to search the internet. Once again, they sat across from each other on their living room couches, each armed with a laptop. David got the first hit. Mark P. O'Leary had registered a porn site called teensexhub.net. The rapist had threatened to post photos of the victims online. As soon as David saw the link, he figured he wouldn't be seeing much of his wife anymore. Stacy's a very driven person when she gets a major case. She'll work 30 to 40 hours straight to get ahead of it. Grusin contacted his counterparts in the investigative arm of the Defense Department to find out whether O'Leary had been in the armed services, something both Amber and Lily had suspected. He got a quick response, but with little detail. O'Leary had enlisted in the Army. He had risen to the rank of sergeant. He had been honorably discharged from active duty. DiGiosio continued her digging. The Lakewood Police Department, like more than 70% of law enforcement agencies in the United States, had invested in a crime-fighting tool called a license plate reader, or LPR. The small, high-speed cameras, they can take 1,800 photos a minute, are affixed to the front of patrol cars. As cops drive around, the readers snap pictures of every license plate passed. The information on the license plate, in addition to the date, time, and location of the photo, is automatically fed into a database. Over time, the database had proven far more useful than any log of stolen underwear. As it turned out, one of the vehicles with a reader was driven by a cop who passed 65 Harlan Street on his way to work. So when DiGiosio typed in the license plate number, she got three hits. One picture captured O'Leary standing next to the white Mazda in his driveway. Another showed the right passenger side mirror, bent just like the mirror of the white Mazda pickup in the surveillance video from Golden. Later, Hendershot pored over DiGiosio's discoveries at her cubicle in Westminster. One of the LPR photos captured the Mazda driving through Lakewood on August 10, 2010. That was the same day Sarah had been raped, Hendershot realized. She looked at the time stamp, 8:49:05 a.m., only 2 hours after the rapist had fled the apartment. Then Hendershot found something even more astonishing. Colorado Department of Motor Vehicles records showed that O'Leary had his picture taken for a new license at 11:13 a.m. on the same day. In the picture, he wore a white T-shirt. Sarah had described her attacker as wearing a white T-shirt. It was an astounding chain of events, but Hendershot was still cautious. Who knew what more they were going to find out? I want the right guy to go to prison forever. You know what I mean? But you can't be narrow in focus. You can have that bit of excitement, but there's still so much more work to do. I can't imagine how horrible it would be to jump to the conclusion and convict the wrong person, right? I'm excited, but there's still so much work to be done, Hendershot said. It had been a chilly morning for the two FBI agents on the stakeout. They sat in their car, parked down the street from O'Leary's home at 65 Harlan Street. Cars whizzed past. The temperature hovered just above freezing. The sky was clear. It was Friday, February 11th, 2011. At 12:13 p.m., a man and a woman stepped out of the house. He was about 6'1", blonde hair, maybe 200 pounds. She had dark hair, looked to be about 20. O'Leary and who? A girlfriend? The pair got into a Toyota Corolla and drove off. The agents followed. They were hoping that O'Leary would go for a sweaty workout, or spit on the ground, or do anything, really, that might result in his leaving body fluid in a public place. Such remnants were called abandoned DNA, genetic material left in the open. Even though the Fourth Amendment required a warrant to gather a suspect's genetic signature from his home or body, the courts had ruled abandoned DNA fair game for police. The agents could collect it. The state crime lab could analyze it. If O'Leary's DNA matched the partial profile from the rapist, they would know that the two men were at least related, if not the same man. O'Leary and the woman drove a half mile to the Lookin' Good restaurant and lounge, a Greek, American, and Mexican diner. The agents waited outside as the couple ate for an hour and a half. When they left, an agent rushed in. He stopped the busboy, who was collecting dishes from the table. After a quick talk with the restaurant manager, the agent walked out with the coffee mug that O'Leary had used. It would have plenty of abandoned DNA on its rim. While the surveillance agents watched O'Leary, Grusing and a local cop ventured to the front door of 65 Harlan Street. They were dressed like civilians, slacks and shirts. They planned to install a surveillance camera to watch the house and wanted to make sure nobody was home. But when Grusing knocked, a man answered. Grusing recognized him immediately. It was Mark O'Leary. Holy shit. Grusing had prepared for the possibility of someone being home, but he hadn't expected it to be the suspect he thought had just left. He fell back on the ruse he had practiced. His partner explained they were cops. Grusing pulled a police sketch from his pocket and showed it to O'Leary. "There's been a bunch of burglaries in the neighborhood," Grusing said. "Seen anybody who looks like this?" In reality, the sketch was from an FBI murder case. Grusing watched O'Leary closely. Did he suspect? O'Leary held the sketch and examined it. If he were the rapist, Grusing thought, he sure didn't show it. He seemed to be thinking, but he didn't seem panicked. "No, I haven't seen that guy," O'Leary told Grusing. He handed back the sketch. "Can I get your name and birth date?" Grusing asked. O'Leary provided them. Still no signs of panic. "Anyone else live here?" Grusing asked. "Just my brother, Michael," O'Leary said. He promised to share the news about the burglaries. As Grusing walked away, he felt like the trick had worked. He had studied bad guys. He knew how they thought. Every cop they saw, every patrol car that passed was a source of paranoia. "The bad guys always think somebody's after them," he said. He knew, too, how they compensated. They simply got used to it. O'Leary would be suspicious of him, but it would be the same distrust he held of every cop who looked too closely at him. He would rationalize it as another close call. He would have no idea how close. It didn't take long to sort things out. The surveillance agents had been following Michael O'Leary and his girlfriend. Michael's DNA was on the coffee mug. Could they use Michael's DNA to compare to the rapist's DNA? Grusing called the director of the state crime lab. "Yes. It didn't matter which male relative provided a sample to compare to the rapist's DNA. They could do the analysis overnight," the director told Grusing. The next day, at 2:15 p.m. on February 12th, Galbraith got the results. The rapist's DNA, the few dozen cells found on Doris's teddy bear, Sarah's white kitchen timer, and Amber's face, matched the cells on the rim of Michael O'Leary's coffee mug. The chance of such a match happening at random was 1 in 4,114 for white males. If you were a gambler, you'd bet that the rapist was an O'Leary man. During the investigation, Grusing and Galbraith met regularly at his office in a turn-of-the-century red brick building in the middle of Denver's dusty stockyards. It had once housed the Denver Union Stockyard Company and had the feel of a bank, with Ionic columns, wide staircases, and aged wood paneling. The FBI office on the top floor felt more like a men's club. The agents had decorated the inside with taxidermy of illegally caught game seized by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. A javelina here, an elk head there. The men's bathroom featured a white porcelain urinal the size of a small refrigerator. The metal Venetian blinds behind Grusing's desk were bent, the victim of an impromptu inner office football game. Now, the two discussed a new set of facts. A day before, they hadn't known that Michael O'Leary existed. Now, they knew he was almost Mark's twin. The two men looked alike. They were almost the same height and were maybe 10 pounds apart. Since the rapist wore a mask, the victims would have a hard time picking between them in a lineup. And Michael was military, too. He had served in the army. What if Michael had been driving Mark's pickup to commit the rapes? Or what if they were working together, taking turns? They still believed that Mark O'Leary was the rapist, but they both knew that a good lawyer would have no trouble making a case for reasonable doubt. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, none of the victims can say for sure which man assaulted her, and neither can modern science. Our legal system says it is better to let 10 guilty men go free than to convict an innocent man. You must acquit. They needed more. That evening, Galbraith wrote an affidavit asking a judge for a warrant to search 65 Harlan Street. She listed all the evidence that pointed to Mark O'Leary, his physical appearance, his time in the military, the DNA match. She cataloged the crimes and the lives ripped apart. Using the dry language of a legal document, she wrote down all the things that she hoped to find in the house to prove his guilt. Items missing from the victims in the cases described above: pink Sony CyberShot camera, nightgown with blue and yellow floral pattern, women's panties, green satin pillowcases, green sheets, a solid pink fitted sheet and two matching pillowcases, a pair of white granny panties, hot pink sheet, snowflake pajamas, black silk-like bindings, white t-shirt, possibly with coloring on the front, gray sweatpants with holes in the knees, greenish khaki pants, gray hoodie, black mask, cap or combination thereof, gloves or other item with a honeycomb pattern or imprint, black Adidas shoes with white stripes, zippered bag or backpack, items of rope, string, twine, or other material that could be fashioned as a ligature, dildo, personal sexual lubricant, water bottle, wet wipes, thigh-high nylons or stockings, vibrator, black camera. Galbraith finished late that evening. The on-duty judge didn't want to read the affidavit in an email. He insisted on a facsimile. Galbraith raced around town until she found one store open late, a Safeway, that had a fax machine. The judge signed the warrant at 10 o'clock on Saturday night. The raid was set for the next morning. Galbraith knew that finding the evidence at O'Leary's house would help the prosecutors build their case, but she needed only one thing to be certain that Mark O'Leary was the rapist. She emailed a crime analyst at another police department. "I so want to see this guy's leg. Bad." At 8:15 a.m. on Sunday, February 13th, Galbraith knocked on the side door of 65 Harlan Street. It was a clear, cold morning. Snow covered the yard. The circling trees stood winter bare. "Police! Search warrant! Open the door!" she shouted. Grusing and six officers from Golden and Lakewood stood behind her, pressed against the south side of the house. They wore bulletproof vests and khaki pants. They had guns drawn. Galbraith heard noises from inside the house. The door swung open. Mark O'Leary stood in the frame. His dog, Arius, and Michael's dog, a pit bull, tumbled out ahead of him. Seeing the cops, O'Leary started to kneel. "Outside! Outside!" Galbraith ordered. He looked dazed as he stepped out into the slanting midwinter sun. He wore a gray hoodie, baggy gray sweatpants, and slip-on house shoes. He told Galbraith that his brother, Michael, had gone out last night and hadn't returned. He was alone. Galbraith pulled him to the side. She patted him down. She knelt down and raised his pants legs. There it was, on O'Leary's left calf, a dark birthmark the size of a large egg. It was him. He was the rapist. Galbraith turned to Grusing. Thumbs up. We have a warrant to search the house, Grusing explained to O'Leary. O'Leary said he wanted a lawyer. At that moment, Galbraith walked up behind him. You're under arrest for burglary and sexual assault, which occurred in the city of Golden on January 5th, 2011, she told him. At 8:35 a.m., Galbraith handcuffed O'Leary. She watched as another officer drove him away for booking in the Jefferson County Jail. He was fingerprinted. A technician ran cotton swabs against the inside of his cheeks to obtain a complete DNA profile. In a photo room, he stripped naked so that a police photographer could take photos of every part of his body. At his first court appearance, on February 14, 2011, O'Leary was charged with sexual assault, kidnapping, burglary, and menacing. Bail was set at $5 million. The judge worried that O'Leary was an extreme danger. Galbraith was wearing new boots the morning of the arrest. Whenever she looked at them in the future, she would remember catching O'Leary. She had wanted to make the arrest herself. I wanted to see the look on his face and for him to know that we figured you out. Golden crime scene investigator Amanda Montano led a team of 11 cops, FBI agents, and criminalists in the search of the house. Westminster's Catherine Ellis had volunteered to help. So had Detective Aaron Hassel from Lakewood and Detective Marcus Williams and criminalist Callie Gibson, both from Golden. They dressed in white jumpsuits with hoods and wore blue surgical gloves and white booties. They looked like a biohazard team swarming the scene of a toxic wasteland. Room by room, the team combed the house. Mark O'Leary's bedroom was in the northeast corner. Black curtains covered the windows. The bed was pushed against one wall, beige sheets bundled in the middle. The floor was clean. There was a dresser with a television set on top. Inside the drawers, everything was neat, orderly, in its place. His shirts and pants were stacked, three piles to a drawer. On the floor of the closet, several pairs of shoes were positioned side by side. Montano noticed that one pair were black sneakers with three distinctive white stripes. They were Adidas ZX700 shoes, just like the website said, Montano thought. She moved to the computer room in the back of the house. Maroon curtains covered a window that normally offered a view of the Rockies. An L-shaped brown desk sat in one corner. On top were a computer, spiral notebooks, and an iPhone. Above the computer, hanging on the wall, was a framed clock with a military coat of arms. Underneath was an engraving thanking Private First Class Mark Patrick O'Leary for his dedicated service to the 3rd Platoon, Cox, A Company, of the 503rd Air Assault Infantry Regiment, one of the units he had served in while in Korea. Military, just like the victims had suspected, Montano thought. Bookshelves rose above the desk. Montano wrote down the titles. A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking. Ethics by Benedict de Spinoza. The Ethical Slut by Dossie Easton and Janet Hardy. A Biography of Sigmund Freud. The Only Astrology Book You'll Ever Need. The Bible. Sexy Origins and Intimate Things. A stack of CD-ROMs in blue plastic cases sat on another shelf. On top of the pile, a pink Sony CyberShot camera. That's almost too perfect, Montano thought. Throughout the day, Montano and the rest of the team sifted through O'Leary's life. In the bathroom hamper, they found a black piece of cloth knotted to form a kind of mask.